outside is frightful, but the fire is so delightful. Since we've no place to go, let it snow, let it snow, let it snow.
This is the time of year for living in Tucson. It's beautiful outside. It's a quick hour drive up to Mount Lemmon where you can actually see some snow and then get back to the warmth for those of you whose blood is already thinned out from living in Tucson for even 6 months. Happy holidays from AZMcast. We've got a stocking full of awesome goodness for you. Some EM edumacation. We've got our ultrasound fellows extraordinaires talking to us about an amazing case that Jared had, of course. And guess what? There's a twist to it. They're going to talk to us about echocardiography in the emergency department, what you should know, what you wish you knew, and what you should be held to go out in the real world. We've got a new segment we're doing called Selling the Admission. For all of you that have ever had a difficult talk with an admitting service about why this patient needs to come in from the ER, come out from the cold, this segment is for you. We're going to be talking with one of our pediatric hospitalists, Dr. Chan Lo, who's going to help us get those treacherous admission waters. And finally, we've got some words of wisdom from Dr. Peter Rosen about what defines the standard of care. Pop it all off with a peer review from Brian Drummond, and you have a holiday delight. Get some cocoa, pretend that it's cold outside, and let's do some AZM casting. Delightful. Since we've no place to go, let it snow,
let it snow, let it snow. And there is no such thing as a no-sale call. A sale is made on every call you make. Either you sell the client, or he sells you on a reason he can't. Either way, a sale is made. The only question is, who's going to close? You or him?
Most of us in emergency medicine do not like being thought of as a used car salesman trying to pitch a deal. Hey, do I got a patient for you? However, sometimes we get stuck in that situation where we know the patient can't go home, or we think the patient can't go home, and we're trying to sell this admission to the admitting service. So, for just that indication, we've decided to do a segment on selling the admission. We're not trying to define admission criteria. We're not trying to teach you how to manipulate a consultant. Instead, we're trying to talk about different disease processes and those gray areas of, can they go home? Do they need to be admitted? Somewhere in between, can we try to figure out a common plan for this patient in order to take the best care of them? And with that, I present to you the world's worst admission call. So I have Dr. Chan Lo here. He's one of the pediatric hospitalists. He's the head of the section of hospital medicine and outreach for the Department of Pediatrics. And he's on call today for peds. So Chan, I've got an admission for you, if you don't mind. I've got a six-month-old with 5 days of cough. I think the kid has bronchiolitis. It has like crackly, wheezy sounds on his lungs, and he's a little bit tachypneic and has some retractions. Parents say he's been drinking a little bit less, but the urine output's been normal, and the sats are holding tight at 93%. So I wanted you to admit him.
Okay. So what would be the criteria that needs to be admitted for?
For bronchiolitis.
Okay. So, but what about his, like, what is it that's concerning him on his exam that he would need to come in for?
Well, his sats are 93%, and he's got some retractions.
Okay. So it sounds like he's still doing okay, I mean, overall. Is there something that would be more concerning that would bring, you know, that we should watch him for, that we should do for him?
Well, they actually saw bronchiolitis on the chest x-ray, so I think it needs to be admitted.
Was there something about his exam that suggested you should get a chest x-ray?
He was coughing, so we decided he was coughing. So and it's been for 5 days of cough. So the parents really wanted a chest x-ray, so we got a chest x-ray, and it showed bronchiolitis. That's what the radiologist said.
Okay.
How do you argue with the radiologist that says that kid has bronchiolitis?
Well, it sounds like at this point he's actually breathing okay. His sats are good. What have you done for him so far?
We got some vitals and a chest x-ray, and then I called you.
Okay. Yeah, but did you suction his nose?
No. We haven't suctioned his nose. I can have the nurse do that, though, but he still needs to be admitted.
Did have you tried? Is he a candidate for breathing treatments? Anything that would potentially improve his status a little bit?
You know, the parents are really uncomfortable. I just think this kid needs to be admitted.
Do you think the parents are uncomfortable because you made them uncomfortable?
You know, I already told the parents are being admitted and that you were going to give them steroids. So if you can just get a bed ready, that'd be great.
Well, why don't I come down and see him? We'll reevaluate.
I don't think you need to do that. I think he just needs to be admitted. Are you refusing this admission?
So far.
Is this similar to any call you've ever had in the past, Jan?
Yeah. We get these from time to time.
So bronchiolitis is what we're going to talk about real quick. And we're going to certainly not define admission criteria, but we're going to talk a little bit about some patients that are on the fence, that I'm not certain how comfortable I feel with this patient going home, so I'd like you to admit, versus kid has bronchiolitis equals dispo. And we're going to talk about from both ends, what do you do with some of these kids that are on the cusp? So bronchiolitis is a clinical diagnosis. So bronchiolitis on a chest x-ray means possibly that the radiologist came to listen to the kid, which would be fantastic. But it's definitely not an imaging diagnosis. So bronchiolitis is usually RSV for the first most common, and paraflu for the second most common. Leads to runny nose, nasal congestion, and lower respiratory tract infection with some crackles and wheezes that generally expands for the full gamut of symptoms, even up to 2 weeks, but usually they get worse on days 3, 4, and 5. So, Chan, what are some of the things that if I would have told you, and by the way, the kid has this, that you might have said, all right, this sounds like a kid that probably would benefit from observation.
Right. Well, so the kid you described is by all intents and purposes, actually doing okay, and is at day 5 and is probably at the worst of their illness. Sats are still good, breathing, it sounds like, relatively comfortably, and may benefit just from some suction you have the nose. I think, sometimes it's hard to paint a picture of what they actually look like, the description of him saying, he's tachypneic with, severe retractions and his nasal flaring, really working hard, even though his sats are good, would suggest that he might, benefit from some further observation and suctioning to try to clear his airway out. Other things that would be helpful, to know is, if this patient happens to live in, Bisbee or San Carlos, where they're climbing up 3,000 feet on the way home, their sats are, borderline here, they're almost certainly going to be hypoxic when they get back. The other thing that oftentimes we'll get kids in is that they're just too congested to eat, and so they're becoming dehydrated and they need some fluid. Bronchiolitis is one of the things where we can't do a whole lot. The main things we can do is suction them, give them nutritional support, fluids. We're even backing off of any NEBS for our straightforward back bronchiolitis at this point.
So there's some new bronchiolitis guidelines that have just come out, and after reviewing the guidelines, it tells us that we should, from an evidence-based standpoint, do what for bronchiolitis?
Basically nothing.
Yay!
The guidelines essentially said, consider oxygen to keep sats greater than 90%, which is certainly reasonable, which I think, in our area particularly, we have to sort of take into account where they're going and coming from. Their elevation, 1,000 or 2,000 feet makes a difference. And then nasal suctioning and clearance. And parents have a little bulb suction at home, and that's often just not good enough. So the wall suction is just a lot stronger, works much better. But that's about it. The general recommendation now for the straightforward bronchiolitic is don't even try a NEB at this point to see if it's going to help. Hypertonic saline in the ED has never been shown to be helpful. There's some data that says it might be helpful once they get admitted to get them out sooner, but beyond that, there's not much.
Yeah, we were just discussing this before recording that it puts us in a difficult place in the ED because the parents come in and we say, your kid has bronchiolitis, we can't do anything. And then they say, well, when my older kid, who's 5, had bronchiolitis, they give him breathing treatments, and that helped out a lot. Well, the guidelines have changed, and now those breathing treatments are harmful, so, or ineffective, that it's kind of a difficult thing of maybe we need to come up with a new plan of attack of talking to parents about what we're going to do for bronchiolitis.
I actually would agree that, and, you know, occasionally they actually will be harmful in that, you know, the kid like this kid who's setting 92-93%, is doing okay, gets a nebulizer treatment and then gets, you know, a VQ mismatch from the albuterol and ends up hypoxic and having to be admitted because they're hypoxic, where they would have actually been okay without the neb.
What happens when you have a bronchiolitis patient or an asthmatic that you give them the nebs and suddenly their sats drop? What's going on there, and is it something we should worry about?
Right. It's a very common phenomenon. It probably happens actually in almost anybody who has lung disease. The issue is, I think a lot of times people physiologically think about it as saying, well, it opens up the bad areas of the lungs and then they don't produce oxygen through those areas, so they drop their sats. But it's almost the exact opposite. The bad areas of the lungs stay closed, so the albuterol doesn't get there. But then the albuterol goes to the good areas of the lungs, diffuses into the bloodstream, and vasodilates the blood vessels that are going to those bad areas of the lungs, so that you induce a shunt, and then those areas, the blood going through those areas, doesn't get oxygenated. So eventually they'll open, you know, if it's an asthmatic, eventually they'll open up, and those, you know, those lungs will start to get aerated again and they'll perfuse, but it's certainly a real phenomenon that happens, and they'll drop their sats by, you know, 5-6% sometimes by doing that.
Yeah. So if you have that happen where you give a breather, a kid that's having breathing problems, albuterol, and they drop their sats transiently, that doesn't necessarily mean that they need to be admitted for that drop. You may have just induced that with your quote-unquote treatment. And we used to say a third of albuterol users will get better, a third will get worse, and a third will stay the same, which is why that's really about as right middle of the road as you can get, that it doesn't really do all that much.
Right. You know, there is some data actually that, you know, if you're going to give a trial of albuterol or racemic, there's actually data. Typically, I think the mindset is, you know, try albuterol because they could go home with it. There's actually a nice study that shows if you use epinephrine, you're more likely to get them home in the emergency room, and you're more likely to get them home faster than if you try albuterol first. So to go to neb in a non, you know, in a baby who does not have a strong history of asthma, eczema, all those other things, probably should be racemic, even in the emergency room for those kids, if we're going to try anything at all. And the new guidelines now are saying don't try anything.
So with the age group, what's the age group that you start to worry about that, you know, you have bronchiolitis, sure, maybe you're on day 3 or day 4, but you look pretty good, but gosh, you're just too young. We actually will do you a benefit by keeping you on the floor, keeping you on a monitor, and not doing anything else but sucking at your nose.
There's kind of a couple subsets, I think. One is, you know, bronchiolitis in general is a disease of kids less than about 2, although it seems like we're seeing more sort of 3-year-olds and stuff with pretty classic clinical bronchiolitis. And the kids who, you know, the one subset of kids who need to come in are the kids who are young. The biggest thing is, particularly with RSV, the kids less than about gestational age 44 weeks, so, you know, full term less than 4 weeks, preterm less than 8 weeks. Or kids who have had a witnessed apneic event. Those are the kids that are at highest risk for apnea. The study done had included several hundred kids they looked at, and they had a negative predictive value of 100% in that study. If they didn't meet any of those 3 criteria, that they would not have apnea. If they were in that high-risk group, then about 30% had apnea. So those kids probably should come in for observation initially to think about, you know, watching them for apnea. The other ones are the ones who are early in their course. And so, you know, most colds, you know, they start to get better around day 3 or 4. This is about the time the bronchiolitis starts to get worse. And so you have the kid who comes in on day 2 and they're already struggling. Odds are they're going to end up, you know, if you send that kid home, quite likely they'll be back the next day now, you know, in distress and needing to be admitted. So that doesn't mean if they look fabulous on day 2, they should come in just because they're on day 2. But it certainly means, you know, if they're already on the fence on day 2, probably they should just come in, as opposed to day 5 or 6 where they've already peaked and they should be getting better at that point.
Yeah, I think we've all, most of us have seen that kid that's sitting there, they're breathing a little fast, they've got a little bit of retractions, but they're hydrated, they can take a bottle, they're the happy wheezers. Right. And those are the ones that you look at and go, man, you look terrible, but you look great. And those are ones that are kind of on the cusp. So there are a few of these factors that can help you determine, are they going to benefit from an admission? Especially now that, you know, you tell us that with the new bronchiolitis guidelines, you're not going to be doing a whole lot on the floor. You're kind of going to be suctioning out their nose and watching them for worsening, clinical worsening. So if you've got parents, caregivers that are reliable, we can tell them how to do this stuff at home if they're able to do that. But certainly less than 44 weeks gestation, if they're hypoxic, less than 90% or even a little bit higher, but they live in a higher elevation, they have an incompetent caregiver, and I mean a truly incompetent caregiver, or their day of illness is they're only on day two or day three of illness and they look questionable. Those might be patients that you can consider. And then if we call you and you say, I'd like to come down and see the patient, I usually see that's a help more than anything else.
Great. We're always happy to do that.
So I'm selling you this admission, and I'm going to change it instead. All right, Chan, I got this six-month-old ex-28-weeker who maybe was having some chronic lung disease and was on oxygen but now isn't, who's had 5 days of cough, is tachypneic, had some retractions, we sucked out the nose, the kid's not able to take a bottle here, and they live with their 14-year-old parents out in the White Mountains. You know, I think this kid would probably benefit from admission. Would you mind being able to watch this kid for me overnight? They're on day of illness number three right now.
Yeah, and I think that's a patient that I would without question say absolutely we'll take them.
Right. Now, do you ever get the oversells though, of where someone is trying to sell you so hard on the admission that you go, man, this kid sounds like they need the unit. Why don't you call the unit and have them see the kid instead? Because wow, that kid sounds sick.
Yeah, that does happen from time to time. You know, we'll have people I think that, you know, for whatever reason, sort of make them sound worse than they really are. And then that leads to, you know, the unit being sent to the PICU or you know, saying, sure, we'll take them, and then seeing the kid and going, wow, they're not as built. So then the next time you call, we're going to sort of be a little more leery about what's being said.
When we're trying to move patients through the emergency department, we have to consider the whole picture. So if you're trying to move patients through the emergency department and you oversell your consult on how sick they are, they hear the terror in your voice, then the hospitalist, who may also be busy, may say, this kid sounds really sick. You probably need to call the PICU, who will then say, either, fine, I'll take the kid, but this is my last bed, or they'll say, yeah, I'll come down and see the kid as soon as I'm able to. Why don't you do this stuff? And then it delays the kid's stay in the emergency department even more. So when you call your consults, first of all, everything has to be true. Second, just have an idea of what some admission criteria would be, what some reasons would be. A kid that's breathing really heavy, that has some of these risk factors we've talked about, are ones that you should consider for admission. But then we were talking about, you know, you have a limited number of beds on the floor, and if we try to get you with a questionable admission that might want to go home, and we take up your last bed, then what happens?
Right, so that's, you know, particularly in the wintertime, and we've been fortunate the last year we didn't run into the situation, but, you know, I certainly remember years where we would have, you know, a constant waiting list of 10 to 12 patients trying to get into our limited beds. So so those are the times when, you know, we gladly will take patients that you send us, but, you know, if it's a patient that seems like they're going to do okay and you know we have two beds left and the patient in the next bed is really sick, then, you know, probably you're going to want to try to, you know, keep that one patient so you can send us the sick kid. Because what happens is once we're full, then you know, we just can't, if we have no more beds, we can't take anymore, which means that you're left managing the patients that are left. And so we've had times actually where, you know, we've had bronchiolytics set in the emergency room for 2 days, and then whenever we finally get a bed, we call back and they say, oh, they got better, so we send them home this morning. And they never end up getting admitted because of space, when they certainly, you know, warranted admission. It just, there was no room to put them anywhere.
The last thing that we like in the emergency department is boarding, right? We're not supposed to be the admitting service. So there's two ED trump cards that we try to throw sometimes, not to reveal all of our secrets. One of them is, the parents are really uncomfortable going home. So,
yeah, and we get that a lot, actually. You know, the parents are just not comfortable taking the patient home. And what I would say is 90, 95% of the time when I go down to talk to the family, they end up saying, oh, sure, we'll go home. Which then makes me wonder, you know, is it just that, you know, they've had more time to process what's going on and see them by the time I get there, and now they're more comfortable, or was that just a sell to try to get me to take the kid? You know, usually I think if I'm told the parents aren't comfortable going home, I'm probably going to say, well, let me come talk to them and see if we can, you know, see if we can rearrange this. And there, admittedly, there are some families who just simply put their feet in the ground and say, we are not going home. And, you know, those are, we just have to figure out what to deal with, you know, how to deal with them. But most of the families end up being pretty comfortable in the end.
And some of that may be, you know, if you haven't done a whole lot of pediatrics, you're not comfortable with it, then I think that's fine to say, I just don't know any more to say, and the parents are really uncomfortable. Will you, the consultant, help me to try to, you know, figure out what the best thing for them to do is? And I think that that's a legitimate way to try to get the patient good care, because they may not benefit from admission. They may be worse off from admission. And so I always say that 10 minutes sitting at their bedside having a conversation may save you 3 hours and the thousands of dollars worth of tests in the ED, and sometimes a hospital admission. So what about the other one of, I'm not comfortable with this patient going home?
Yeah, I think, you know, if somebody, you know, ED doc was to call me and say, I'm not comfortable sending him home, then I'd probably ask, you know, my first question would be, what is it about it that you're not comfortable with, to try to figure out where we're at? And then, you know, ultimately, if it's a kid that really actually could go home, then, you know, what you may find is actually the hospitalist may offer to actually discharge the patient for you, which in that case, you know, we put in the discharge order. The responsibility comes on us for sending him home. Not that I would encourage, you know, that every, you know, we have to come down and write the discharge order for everybody, but there are some patients, you know, that we just disagree on. You know, you feel like they need to come in, I feel like they don't, and then, you know, that might be one potential way to resolve that issue.
So should we just call and say, Chan, I don't have time to take care of this. Will you talk to the patients and take my liability for me?
Right. So that's the danger, I think, in that. But, you know, I think with a hospital specialist, especially, you know, we are certainly happy to be a resource and come down. And I think, you know, like you say, sometimes, too, just seeing that second phase of, you know, now it's the hospital doctor, and somehow we carry some, you know, clout that helps us to get, you know, I don't know, whatever it is. But sometimes families respond to that. And so just seeing a second person, you know, backing you up and saying, oh, actually, this, your child's okay, they can go home. Sometimes that's enough to help them to get over their discomfort.
I think it's the team. You have the attending and the resident and the intern and the medical student. Wow, all four of these people agree I should go home. Right. That's really, really helpful. So maybe you just need to put some lab coats on, you know, people in the ED and have them all go in at once. I think that it's important when we're calling the consultants to realize that it's a team sport to take care of these patients.
Excellent.
And when you have these patients that are on the fence, to just be honest and go, I'm kind of on the fence about this patient. I think they might be able to go home, but something about it makes me nervous, and they'll be able to weigh in. Now, we have the benefit here of you guys are generally in-house or can be very quickly.
Right.
What about when you get a similar call from somewhere like Bisbee, White Mountain, Safford, some of these outlying hospitals in southern Arizona where you can't go and see the patient?
Right. Yeah, when we're in a situation like that, you know, we get a call from Bisbee or whoever, then, in all honesty, you know, patients that, you know, if they describe the same patient to me in the ED, I might say, you know what, that kid could probably go home, I'll go see them. And, you know, if they're in Bisbee and I can't do that, then I'm in a position where I really have to say, okay, I'll take them. I may be able to talk through different things, you know, and discuss with the ED doc, but at the end of the day, if I can't see the patient, then I can't decide the patient can go home. So then, you know, ultimately, if you're in a you know, remote area and you're transferring the patient to a place, then, you know, you kind of have to be willing to say, look, I'm the one seeing this kid, and I feel like they need to be admitted. And the hospital should accept that and say, yes, we'll take them.
And see, they do trust us sometimes, unless they can see the patient themselves. So, Chan, thank you very much. We look forward to many phone calls over the ensuing months as RSV plagues our city. So
it's on its way.
Take care.
I'm all for evidence-based medicine, but when you take away the only tools I had to convince a parent that their kid was okay, and you tell me I can do nothing, now I'm angry. These new bronchiolitis guidelines are good, they're great evidence-based, but unfortunately they kind of tie our hands a bit, so how these pan out in actual clinical practice has yet to be seen. Hopefully you guys took away the important messages from this is that we should try to work with our consultants and not against them, but you need to know the important things, the buzzwords to say for your admission. So you're going to tell a surgeon something different than you're going to tell an internist, then you're going to tell a pediatrician, then you're going to tell an obstetrician. So get an idea of what they're looking for so that you can try to make the transition of care as quick and painless as possible.
A million ways to die.
Ah! Ah! That went south so fast! Ah!
All right, Jared's got the case this month, and we are also joined by two of our ultrasound fellow supremes, Dr. Matthew Thompson and Dr. Nico Nicholas Hobaker.
Hey, yo. Both of which are smarter, better looking, and funnier than us, so don't get used to them being on. We don't want to replace
AZEMcast. All three of those, actually.
We don't want to replace AZEMcast with Matt and Nico Hour.
Gosh, that'd be great, though. It'd be so much easier for us. We'll just keep the name. All right, so Jared's got the case this month.
Okay, so
let her rip, Papa Bear.
So a 56-year-old guy comes in. Story is he was at an outside hospital 2 weeks earlier.
I already don't like this.
Yeah. So goes into the outside hospital 2 weeks earlier for chest pain, was admitted for pneumonia for 2 weeks, is on antibiotics for 2 weeks, gets discharged home. Goes home, has a fever, is diaphoretic, short of breath. Wife finally says, you know what? I've had enough. I'm taking you to the hospital. So she drives him into our hospital. So on exam, he is diaphoretic and short of breath, hypoxemic, crackles all throughout his lung bases. Now, you two are ultrasound extraordinaires. What would you do in the evaluation of the acutely unstable dyspneic patient?
Call Jared Mosher.
I was the ICU attending, so I wasn't involved until later.
So, us being ultrasound on the ultrasound path to enlightenment, I would definitely want to look at this guy's heart, do a bedside echo.
Okay, but what are you looking for specifically?
Well, so based on your exam, you're telling me we have a hypoxic guy with crackles in his lungs. So, you know, it's a very differential, but I would want to look for signs of heart failure, right heart strain. You'll rule out things like an obvious large PE or new onset congestive heart failure.
Explain to our colleagues, when you say I'm going to look for heart failure, what are you looking for? And I'll tell you what we saw.
Okay, so
I was going to break it down a little more simply, because that's why I'm here, is to ask the simple questions, pretend like I didn't know the answer, because I didn't. So you start with your first view. You got a guy who comes in hypoxic, crackly. What's your first view going to be? What are you going to go for first on your cardiac sono? You're going to go for your apical 4, your subxiphoid, your IBC. What is your most high-yield view?
That's a good question. I think it varies by patient. You know, in the patient who has COPD, maybe has poor, parasternal views, maybe you can start with subxiphoid, apical. Really, I don't think there's a go-to view for me that is the one-size-fits-all. I think it kind of varies based on patient anatomy, physiology.
Yeah, I think that the view, I think that's very true. And oftentimes, a lot of these patients have poor views, but probably the one that tells me the most information would be the parasternal lung right off the bat. Because you get a good view of both the RV and the LV as far as global function, and you can tell right off the bat if there's like a pericardial effusion. But sometimes you just can't get that view.
I find the patients are less likely to hit me if I don't start with the subxiphoid view and punch them right in the bread box, you know? I tend to go for the parasternal lung as well.
All right, so tell me what you're looking for. You said I'm going to evaluate signs of heart failure. Tell me what you're looking for, and I'll tell you if it was there or not.
So, like Matt said, you know, if you start with the parasternal long axis, you can just I guess what I would do is just look overall, like global assessment, just eyeball it.
Okay.
Is this patient's heart barely moving, or is it hyperdynamic, or somewhere in between?
Tachycardic, overall, global contractility is okay.
Okay.
And no effusion, obviously.
No effusion.
So I guess after this, I would want to make sure I go through all views to ask the exact same questions, because sometimes you can see things in certain views that you just really can't see in others. So even if everything looked globally okay, as far as my contractility and no obvious effusion, I'd want to look at other views as well to confirm that majorly. And then also look at the IVC and see if it's plethoric or if it's highly collapsible.
IVC is plethoric.
Okay.
He's got a high worker breathing, so it collapses a little bit, but it is plethoric.
Okay.
I guess maybe one of the other things that we haven't mentioned yet is just looking for wall motion abnormalities. Usually what I look for on that is I'll go to the parasternal short axis view and just look to see if there's concentric squeeze, mostly of the left ventricle.
So the person that did the bedside echo, I'm not sure, hit the enough of the 16 segments that I could say segmental wall motion abnormality or not.
Mm-hmm. You mentioned like the 16 different segments. I think in emergency medicine, that's not what we're looking for. I think.
Thank God.
32, 64, 128 segment is really how I do it. But
I think we're doing much more of a limited cardiac exam. You know, we're just looking for, is there a major wall motion abnormality?
Nothing globally abnormal.
Okay.
So beyond this, at this point, I would switch probably, and this is where kind of you kind of delineate somebody who's just a basic emergency medicine training versus those of us on the path to ultrasound enlightenment. So I think that for me, I would probably go into a little more advanced echo at this time, but also I'd want to look at a quick thoracic views as well. See if they have signs that point towards paraneumonic effusion, pneumonia, lots of B lines to suggest pulmonary edema, pneumothorax, things like that, hemothorax, pleural effusions, and that's easy to do as well.
Okay, tons of B lines.
Okay, tons of B lines. Okay, so...
Yeah, but I just want to throw out a comment there. That's pulmonary edema,
yeah,
but it doesn't differentiate between cardiogenic and non-cardiogenic pulmonary edema.
Correct, it does not, no. But sometimes you're surprised, you expect to see just pulmonary edema, and you may see something completely different, so...
Okay, so one of your ultrasound colleagues did the bedside echo.
Yeah.
I had come down. Patient's in ARDS, chest x-ray looks bad, pulmonary edema, and was told the echo looked okay. So I come down, we intubate him, ARDS, difficult to oxygenate, we prone him, paralyze him, and I leave. And my fellow calls me and says, you need to come back, he's doing worse. So I come back, and I echo him myself. Pulmonary edema is completely resolved, which doesn't make any sense, right? Why all of a sudden would the pulmonary edema be completely resolved if this patient had pneumonia, now you're thinking he's got ARDS, presumably from an infection, he was febrile. So we take him to the ICU and try to figure out what is going on, get a formal echo, and on the formal echo, what we find is blown mitral valve. So it probably 2 weeks earlier at the other outside hospital probably wasn't pneumonia. It was probably an MI.
Mm-hmm.
And then 2 weeks goes by and he ruptures a valve.
Mm-hmm.
So the question I have for you all is the standard of care in emergency medicine ultrasound to miss that?
This is a tough question. So we're a little bit prepared for this question. So we did. So Nico and I did some research. We called our lawyers. So
I think the answer depends, and this is well defined by the kind of bodies that govern our specialty. A couple of years ago, CORD, SAEM. AEUS and some other, and ASAP got together and put together a consensus about what emergency medicine doctors should know when it comes to bedside ultrasound, in all the different studies that we do. Specifically in cardiac, what they said the graduating emergency medicine physician should know is we should be able to look and assess for an effusion. We should be able to look at global left ventricular function. We should be able to look and assess right ventricular size. And we should be able to look determine asystole.
That's all fine and good.
Mm-hmm.
However, you guys are the prime example of mission creep, right? You've already told me you're going to look for segmental or non-segmental wall
mm-hmm.
motion abnormalities.
Sure.
Like,
yeah.
And
to me, I think that's much more difficult than valve assessment.
Yeah.
Well, and that's why I said it depends. Because they also came out with another set of guidelines that say, for people who have advanced training, here's what we're looking for. And that includes everything else, segmental wall motion abnormalities, valvular pathologies,
yeah.
and other things.
And they did further define advanced skills as fellowship-trained skills. So those of you who aren't fellowship-trained, based on the compendium and these recommendations, for valvular assessment purely, medical legally, you're probably off the hook based on these, if we're following these recommendations. But that being said, for the advanced skills, they're still really fuzzy as to what those advanced skills include. They don't really define valvular pathology or valvular assessment at all. So does that mean you should be able to assess all four valves equally and determine amount of regurg, amount of stenosis, or presence of those at all? It doesn't really say. So I think it's unclear. So for us, it depends on the level of training and your level of comfortability, I guess.
Okay, so bringing this back to our case, the question I have for you is, could we have avoided prone positioning, paralytics, inhaled nitric oxide, APRV, and all that stuff by finding the ruptured valve on bedside echo and going straight to the OR? Yes. My question to you two is, should we be expected to?
Yes, every intern in emergency medicine should be expected to diagnose. No.
And not residents. Should you, when you go work at St. Mary's, be expected to do that?
I think if you're going to expect an emergency medicine graduate to uphold a certain standard, then it needs to be a uniform standard that is agreed upon by a body or a board. And currently, we have excellent recommendations already that exist that say that, no, in fact, you shouldn't be expected to uphold that standard. That may vary from residency to residency on how they want to continue to train. And some places are going to be more heavy on their critical care education, which I think is great, because the more you stretch somebody and prepare them, the more they're going to be able to deal with those situations and more they're going to be able to see. But to expect all emergency physicians to be able to have the same amount of critical care or ultrasound training is beyond the bare minimum is going to be difficult to do, I think.
So let me ask a different question. If you are an ultrasound fellowship trained emergency doctor and you do your bedside ultrasound and you say, this looks like heart failure and the function is okay right now, there's pulmonary edema, you find all the things that the previous doctor we described did, should you say, but I don't look at everything, so you guys should probably get a regular echo as well?
I think that probably depends on case to case and what you're looking for. If you're simply looking for, does this person have an effusion, I think you probably are pretty comfortable telling that. If you're looking for
endocarditis,
again, I think that probably varies. Some cases it's very clear that we can see that. But if it's more subtle and you don't see it, can you completely rule it out based on a bedside ultrasound that you do in the emergency department? No, we all know that the standard is a TEE, so I think it varies.
I guess, Tony, go ahead, you're asking something.
Oh, I was just thinking some clinical questions are easy to answer, and some are complex, and we're good at answering, you know, simple ones and some complex ones. And if the patient's clinical presentation warrants further investigation into why they're decompensating or not improving, then of course you're going to order further testing. So if you find your answer, or you find nothing and the patient improves, or you find another reason, do you need a confirmatory study? No, I don't think you do.
I guess I'm torn because, you know, as we say, we are heavy in critical care education, emergency medicine and critical care are blurring the lines more and more. I get up there and preach about how we need to start guiding our resuscitations with bedside echo and whatnot. You know, as we say this, the multi-specialty, you know, multi-society ultrasound gurus within critical care put out this document last year or earlier this year, I can't remember exactly when it was, that showed what they thought was a standard bedside echo or point-of-care echo for critical care echocardiography. And, you know, we're saying that critical care is critical care. Do we have different rules, especially when we are the specialty that leads the way in point-of-care ultrasound? So although in 2014 we're not doing that, in 2010 we weren't measuring TAPSE and wall motion abnormalities, what should we be doing in 2020? Because that's going to be here before we know it.
Yeah. I think every year we've seen residents and interns come in with more and more knowledge. The interns who are coming in now have knowledge that I think surpasses the seniors who graduated 2 years ago. The machines are getting better.
That's you, Dr. Leach.
Yeah, that's I was about to say, that's absolutely true.
So if this trend continues, then absolutely. I think the things that, you know, interns will be doing 10 years from now is going to surpass what Matt and I are dedicating a whole year to learning.
So when I work my shift next Monday with Dr. Leach, and a patient comes in who's unstable, same presentation, and the third-year resident comes to me, says they want to do a bedside echo, what should I ask them to look for?
Depends on what your clinical concern is.
Yeah,
stop giving me these radiology answers.
You tell me what I should be teaching.
No, here's how I think. You should be doing something to answer a specific question. So if you have a patient who is hypotensive, you should have a set of a checklist of things that you want to rule out, and that's why you should be performing. You shouldn't be putting a probe on somebody just hoping to find something or find an answer, because you need to be answering, at least with point-of-care ultrasound, the way you can be most successful is to do it to answer a specific question, because that way you won't get over your head. You either can answer the question or you can't. If you can't answer the question, then you need more confirmatory testing.
I think this is incredibly important, what Matt just said, and I hope you guys keep this in mind, because in emergency medicine, our job is to look for the worst-case scenario, and if everything comes back and we don't find anything, sometimes we just have to be comfortable saying, well, it's none of these bad things. So I think having a checklist of things that you can look for that you don't find is different from saying normal study.
Yeah, and again, sensitivity and specificity varies with each study, you know, depending on what you're looking for. And I think that we can do an excellent job, you know, abiding by these core compendium rules and of what we should be expected to do. They're easy yes or no questions. Does this person have LV global dysfunction? Do they have a dilated RV? Do they have a pericardial effusion? Are they in asystole? Do they have tamponade physiology?
That one I can tell.
Yeah, that one definitely. So those are things, if you're going to concentrate on those things in training and what all emergency physicians should be upheld to, that's a definite yes. And then everything else is on an expert advanced level.
Where do you think in the timeline of the patient evaluation the bedside ultrasound fits in? Because I've seen everywhere from, well, they're an unconscious, unresponsive rolling, let me grab the ultrasound, to I've intubated, I've given fluids, I've got them on pressors, I need to go grab the ultrasound and drag it in there and take a look. Yeah. Do you use ultrasound to guide what you're doing or confirm what you've done?
It varies. And again, like, there, you know, both Nico and I have worked in places where we don't have ultrasound easily accessible. So you have to use it kind of secondarily. And I think probably a lot of people who are going to graduate or people who go out and people are practicing now are in that exact same situation. Probably more so than not, right? But if you have somebody comes in who you are completely undifferentiated, the best thing you can do for that patient is stabilize them and try to determine or rule certain things that could be surgical or immediate emergencies, you know, out as quickly as possible. So I think that they go hand in hand. I mean, nobody says you can't start to resuscitate somebody while you, at least in an academic center, while you ultrasound them. So it literally takes, you know, to rule out a pericardial effusion, it takes 5 seconds to put the probe on. And to rule out a AAA and a hypotensive, you know, old dude takes, you know, 5 minutes at the most, even for, you know, a resident. So I think we're lucky that the technology doesn't necessarily have to hinder us and prevent us from resuscitating at the same time.
I think that what you said earlier was very important. You don't just want to put a probe on and say, well, let me take a look and see if I happen to find anything. You have to have a question.
Yeah.
I think any time that you order a test, whether it's an imaging study or a lab or an EKG, you got to say, what am I looking for? Because if you don't have anything that you're particularly looking for, it's just a reflex to order a test. Who knows what you're going to find and what are you going to do with that info when you found it? So I think that something like the rush protocol or our chest pain protocol that you guys have spelled out, which we'll put in the summary that Cliff sends out, that's a good question of, do you have an explanation for what I'm looking for? Why are you hypotensive? That's your question. Why are you having chest pain? Is it because of a aortic dissection or a PE or you know, any of these other things that we could be looking for? That's what you're looking for when you put the ultrasound on.
True that.
For reals, yo.
Be interesting what happens in 5 years. It'd be like, people are gonna be listening to this 5 years from now and be like, what were they thinking?
Yeah.
You know, it's like how people in the old days said,
how does this guy's in prison now?
Yeah. How does the television fit into the American lifestyle?
Yeah.
Very what do you cool. think? How do you use ultrasound?
So, you know, I work over in peds. I use it a lot to determine whether or not...
You work in peds?
I do.
Oh, okay.
Have you noticed that?
Yeah.
That's why we never see each other. You're not allowed within 50 feet of a peds ED.
That's true. I can't. It's been really hard.
I mean, there are certain things that we can look for on ultrasound that are just great, and we get to do it at bedside. Fast exams. I mean, I take it a little more simply in pediatrics because it's still evolving as far as emergency pediatrics. There are people that ultrasound long bone fractures and such. It's all in getting the next person in line for dispo to agree that they think your study is valid. And I don't see any of our orthopedists right now saying, oh, it's an excellent ultrasound of your long bone fracture. I'll be right down. They want the x-ray. So, and the same with our cardiologists. Right now, when I say, yeah, I think there's an effusion on this kid's heart with pericarditis, great, we'll send our echo tech down because we want to confirm it. So it takes a little bit of getting your colleagues to buy in that what you're doing is, I don't want to say legitimate, but what you're doing is actually valid before you can say, yes, I can use this in my everyday practice. Because if the cardiologist you're calling, the CT surgeon that's going to take out the clot, the ICU doc that's going to deal with the patient you thrombolyze for your PE doesn't trust your skills, then you're not doing your patient any favors.
Sage was telling me the other day, you know, he's at the University of Michigan now, and he had a patient that came in that they did a bedside echo, him a resident right away, and it was, you know, hypodynamic, big dilated left ventricle, systolic failure, and the guy was short of breath and whatnot, and they put him on BiPAP and started him on dobutamine, and he was doing great. And the ICU team said, I don't believe in your bedside ultrasound. I don't know if you know what you're looking at. Gave him 3 liters of fluid. He ended up in pulmonary edema and on a ventilator.
Wow.
I think you make a good point, Leish, and I think that is changing. I think, you know, it started with maybe our surgical colleagues, and they'll take a patient to the OR based on our fast exam. And I think, you know, I've had conversations with the CT surgeons here who have looked at our ultrasound and said, yes, this is a big dilated RV. This patient has a PE. I would take this patient to the OR based on this bedside ultrasound. And that's not the case for every colleague that we have in the hospital, but I think things are changing.
So I think it's little by little, but I absolutely believe that ultrasound is going to replace stethoscopes in about 10 years. As soon as they get small enough, as soon as they get hooked into a centralized system with good quality assurance, then I think that they're far more useful for everything except wheezing.
You know, one thing,
if you can make it like, if you can find a Doppler study that will kind of like amplify wheezing, like dolphin noises or something, it'll be all over.
You know, one thing that's a little bit interesting is, you know, let's take PE for example. If you know how to do an echo to evaluate for PE very well, and I don't, how responsible am I for knowing how to do that, or learning how to do that, or trying to get to the level that you're at? Because we're both emergency physicians. Mm-hmm. And it's a little bit weird that within emergency medicine, you can do something really well that I can't do. It kind of goes against the motto of emergency medicine, right?
I guess, but there are many skill sets in emergency medicine, and, you know, I may be able to innovate far greater than you can, Jared, but, you know, you may be able to lyse a perirectal abscess way better than me. So it's just, there's a lot of skill sets.
He's got a gentle touch.
Yeah, I do. I think the way that this starts is you choose some basic criteria, and then you adhere all emergency physicians to it. And this conversation started with a very complex skill set related to advanced echocardiography, which is great. And there are going to be people who are trendsetters and trailblazers in this and using this in the ED more and more frequently. But it is all for naught, especially with other services and how they view us, if you can't get everyone to uniformly do the basics really well. So my line of thinking is you're probably right. In the next 10 years, there's going to be a whole new standard. But for now, we should concentrate on everybody upholding a minimum standard. And I think that is pretty well laid out in the compendium. And that's the things we talked about before. Global dysfunction, LV, RV size, basic things like asystole, pericardial effusion. And then once everybody can confidently say that they can all use that efficiently and accurately, then other services are going to take notice and start to respect those skills, and we can move forward.
With ultrasound, if I'm a level one dungeon master right now for ultrasound, or level two,
yeah.
And so for cardiac, I can look at exactly what you said. You know, I can look for effusion, global function, RV, LV size. So if I look and I get a great parasternal lung, but I don't know that this aortic root is massively dilated, I just don't even know what I'm looking for, mm-hmm. and I don't do anything about it, and the patient ends up having a dissection or having a bad outcome. This may be too much for you guys to talk about, but am I liable for that? If I, you know, I documented my malpractice beautifully on a clip of the ultrasound, but man, I didn't have any idea what I was looking at.
Good question. I think we're in the unfortunate era that if a patient is under our care and they have a bad outcome because we missed something, regardless of what we used or what skills we used to do it, we missed it, and we are probably and can be medically, legally liable for it. So even if you don't know those skills, if you put that probe to the chest, you're assuming some liability, unfortunately, right now, I think.
Yeah, I mean, it's a good question, right? Because you're level two. What if one of your residents is Dan Falvey, who knows more about ultrasound than either of us combined, and he goes in and does an ultrasound and sees something that you don't know what you're looking at, but he's your resident and he did the exam. Are you liable for that?
I am grateful for residents that are smarter than me. That's how I make it through my shift. They come up and go, hey, guess what? I found out this guy had such and such. Yeah, and of course you would do what with that? Yes, absolutely. You would call endocrinology surgery. Yes. Great. We'll make that happen.
Maybe we should leave this topic at that you make it through your shift because your residents are smarter than you.
Yeah.
That's not a surprise to anybody.
All this talk about consensus guidelines and standard of care and medical liability, admission criteria, after a while, the art of medicine kind of seems to fall away a bit. So I was fortunate enough to get to sit down with Dr. Peter Rosen, who's really the father of the specialty, and ask him one question. Why one question, do you ask? Because after I ask my question, I really don't have any follow-ups. The question I asked him was, who defines the standard of care for emergency medicine?
I like this. Yeah. Well, you've pushed one of my buttons. I hate guidelines because they aren't guidelines, they're mandates. They start out in good intent. The society says, I want to help my members to protect them from criticism in areas where it's not easy to manage patients, where there are lots of errors made, and if we can give them a safe practice, that they can at least look at that practice and start from there, then they'll be more defensible. Instead of which, a group of guys sitting around a room, many of whom are very smart, many of whom are very experienced, and some of whom don't practice medicine anymore, come up with a set of rules that are all-encompassing, that don't fit any single patient, and really aren't useful guidelines. And you are free to ignore them. I don't think that you can define a standard of care. I think that doctors ought to stop worrying about a standard of care. It's a legal term. And whatever you think it is, they're going to think it's something else if it brings the money. And there's going to be a doctor who will come in and say, it is that other thing, because it brings him money. So forget about the standard of care. Think about, what is a safe practice? What do I need to do to make it safe for this patient? Can't be perfect. Without being perfect, how can I make it safe, make a minimum number of errors, and do what is necessary to make the patient feel better? Now, if guidelines help me to get started on a patient, then fine, use them. But don't rely on them as either protection or as a recipe for best care.
Merry Christmas and happy holidays. From the Drummond household, you were just listening to My 10-Year-Old Thor Trumpet, Jingle Bell Harmony. What a master of a fifth-grade trumpet. So we had some good stuff this time. First thing was bronchiolitis and selling admissions with Aaron and Chan. So a couple of quick points, I think, for the admission portion. Don't admit non-admittables. If you have patients that you admit on a regular basis that don't need to be admitted, you're going to build up the reputation we kind of talked about before. So you got to have good reasons when you do an admission, so that when you have that little old lady with the dwindles that you don't know what to do with and you're punting to somebody else to take care of, those are the times you call in your favor. So how do you figure out what the admission criteria are for certain disease processes? Over the last few years, I've talked to case managers saying, I want this heart failure patient admitted. What do I need to tell the consultant to get them admitted? And what do you need? And so the case managers will give you the information that you need. Maybe it's an oxygen saturation that needs to be documented. Maybe it's a chest x-ray finding. Maybe it's a duration of symptoms or some criteria that need to meet. But that's a good resource to find out what you really need. As Aaron said, buzzwords are key. So know the language that your consultants want to hear. Tell them what they want to hear and what they need to hear. In terms of bronchiolitis is a very easy disease to have difficulty in understanding. It is a very simple disease that is clinically based, but it took me 3 years of residency to really define and understand what bronchiolitis is. So what is bronchiolitis to me? Well, it's a kid with a viral illness, lots of secretions, lower sats, and wheezes. That's it. That's all I care about. Maybe I'll define them as bronchiolitis. Maybe I'll define them as an upper respiratory infection. It's because they're overlapping in their spectrum of disease, right? Viruses, asthma, reactive airway disease, bronchiolitis. There's a lot of overlap in these. So if I have a kid with a viral illness and normal sats, probably not going to call them bronchiolitis. Probably going to call them a viral upper respiratory infection. And it doesn't matter what I call them, because I'm sending them home because they look good. Now, if I have a kid with a viral illness and increased work of breathing, I can call them bronchiolitis maybe if they have lots of secretions, or I can call them viral illness and also send them home. So what you really are looking at is that kid with a viral illness or viral sounding illness, how are their sats, how's their work of breathing, and do they have wheezing? And if you put those together, you'll come up with a reasonable approach to bronchiolitis. Now, I know these guidelines Aaron talked about are pretty stringent, don't do anything, and that kind of sucks. The problem is you look at their recommendations are based after a diagnosis of bronchiolitis. And in their first part, they tell you that bronchiolitis is a clinical diagnosis and you should be able to make this. And they put that as a level B recommendation. And everything based on level A is based on the B recommendation they did in the first place. Well, we see a lot of bronchiolitis or viral illness or other disease process that are not as simple and straightforward. So you get a kid with shorter breath, maybe some decreased sat, maybe some reactive airway disease, maybe a history of asthma. I'm going to try medications on these kids because if they help them, yay, I'm happy. If they don't and the sats drop, okay, now I have a test that I have just defined the illness of the patient. Or maybe it doesn't matter and I'm going to do the same thing no matter what. So I think it's okay and you are not wrong to try these medications. So just know that. If you want to try some racemic epi or albuterol or steroids in your little kid who's having a little trouble breathing, maybe some wheezing, that's okay. You are not a bad person. You still can pass go and collect $200. As for the ultrasound case, great discussion here. The points I want to bring up are the following. I love, from my previous life as an alien, jelly and probes. So when you talk ultrasound, my tingly bits are more than tingling. They're just happy and joyous and bouncing off the wall. So I just want to go through the quick points that Matt and Nico were talking about and just give my perspective on these. I do a lot of ultrasound. I'm definitely not the masters of the Jedi universe that they are, but here's my quick takes. So what is my go-to view? Number one, parasternal lung. Number two, apical. Number three, short axis. Number four, subxiphoid. That's my rank list of what I think the view provides most information for me. In question of what are you looking for? The first things, I agree with all of them. You're looking for an effusion, yes or no. You're looking for contractility, you know, good, bad, or in between. You're looking for right ventricle, left ventricle. You can look for aortic root. You can look for other things. But again, as Aaron talked about and Matt talked about, you're looking to answer a specific question, so that is key. To answer some of Jared's questions, is the standard of care to miss a blown mitral valve with our skills? My answer is yes. And this kind of addresses some of the questions that they had later, where he's talking about what is the skill set that we all should have and we can all bring to the table and what are the standards. And I think they're pretty well addressed, but we have different standards for procedures and how we practice emergency medicine. Even though we try to hold ourselves to the same, there are some people who are better at doing histories. There's some people who are better at sewing up lacerations. There are some people who can do certain procedures with ultrasound. And that's why there's core privileges and then there's additional privileges. And the core privileges should include basic things that we can all do. But some core privileges are broad coverall statements at your institution that aren't necessarily specifying what ultrasounds you do or what ultrasounds you don't do. But I think you have to be true to your own self. If you don't feel comfortable and have not done a lot of peritonsillar abscesses, maybe you shouldn't be going after those. That's in the best interest of the patient. If you are really good at ultrasound and the best interest of the patient is you doing your ultrasounds and making clinical decisions based on that, then you should do that. But to say that someone else has to have the same skill set or will have the same skill set, that's a different question. You can't hold everyone to the same. We're all going to be inherently different, and you just hope that you can practice as best you can and be true to yourself. And the other question Jared had, should we be expected to find these or be held to this standard? And my answer is no. So this was kind of addressed by Matt and Aaron later. You have to do your ultrasounds to answer specific questions. So if I'm doing an ultrasound to answer a specific question from syncope or shortness of breath or a code situation, I'm going to do that ultrasound. As much knowledge as I can gain from that, I will use in my decision-making process. However, I am not going to define all the leaflets of the valves and all the segmental wall motion abnormalities that a formal ultrasound would do, or a formal echo. So in those patients that I'm admitting for heart failure, I'm going to have them get a formal ultrasound. Now, if it is a epigastric pain and I am looking for gallstones and I see no gallstones and I see a normal gallbladder wall, no pericholecystic fluid, no sonographic Murray sign, and a common bile duct that's within normal limits, I'm going to send that patient home and not order a formal ultrasound. So I think it depends on the ultrasound that you're doing, your skill set in that, and is there anything else that the formal test is going to offer that you may not be evaluating that could be useful for the patient in their care. The other aspect of this is, no matter how good you are at ultrasound, there could be and will be a patient that you cannot get the views that you want, whether it's body habitus or you're just not having a good day. Either way, you're not going to get those views that you want. You're not going to get the images that you want to answer the question that you want answered. And in those cases, there is nothing that you can do other than punting and having someone do a formal ultrasound. And that is okay. You're passing the decision on to someone who has more time and can sit for 30 to 45 minutes with the patient, where you can't because you're managing an emergency room at that time. I do think it was funny that Aaron and Jared decided to hit up ultrasound fellows and ask them big questions mid-year before they have finished their ultrasound training, so they don't have even the full complement of their training under their belt to make the most educated answers. But this is what Aaron and Jared do. They make you uncomfortable and put you in awkward positions. Maybe like a game of Twister with Aaron and Jared. There's a lot of good comments on this, and I think Jared and Aaron and Matt and Nico talked about some cultural changes and how do you take ultrasound so that someone buys into what you're doing in your studies. I've had this through my career where trying to change culture, where I started initially in any ultrasound you did had to have a formal no matter what you saw. And you have the ruptured bleeding ectopic with the good ultrasound images and the OBs saying, please send them to get a formal ultrasound. We don't necessarily trust you. And that's disconcerting and very frustrating. So things that I have found in my time that has helped in cases where I have a consultant that does not agree or understand my ultrasound skills, I invite them to the bedside and say, hey, why don't you come down and see this patient for acute chole? I'll show you my images and show you what I'm doing. I had a surgeon from the University of Pennsylvania who was all high and mighty because he graduated from the University of Pennsylvania, which is so dominant to anything else. And you have to be an awesome ultrasound person to even see a pneumothorax on ultrasound. As I was trying to admit a patient who had fallen, and I had a great lung sliding with a transition point with broken ribs, and I said, you know, he's got a pneumothorax. No, it's not on the chest x-ray. Well, it's here on ultrasound. Oh, you can't see that on ultrasound. So I showed him at bedside. Oh, you're just missing something. And needless to say, he would never learn, but he probably doesn't learn anyway. But I had other surgeons who would start to buy into your gallbladder ultrasounds. And when you get good at it and you show them images and they believe you, you slowly change the culture. And you're going to change it one person at a time. You're not going to change everybody, but invite them down, show them what you can do, show them what you're looking at. And a lot of them are excited because they can learn it themselves and take it to their clinics or take it to their offices and apply for privileges. This helps them with billing and reimbursement. That's all I have here on peer review. Hope you all had a good 2014, and we'll talk to you in the new year. Enjoy.
Just when I thought Brian was going to leave us a little Christmas present, maybe be nice to us for a change, he drops some of his typical sass. So thank you, Brian, for your wonderful peer review. We thank you all for listening. We hope you guys had a wonderful year, just as Brian said. And we look forward to next year, where we're going to have more and more awesome stuff. We want to keep doing selling the admission. Let us know if you have any admissions. that you have found to be particularly difficult to sell, and Jared and I will try to find someone and record with them and try to get an idea of how to work together as a team. We also would like to involve our residents a bit more, our nurses a bit more, so if you have any ideas, you want to be on the podcast, it's really not that difficult, just ask Jared. But we thank you guys very much for listening. We look forward to having more for you next year, and have a happy new year.